Okay, so I start college and I don't have a major.
They're steady talking about,
what do you want to do with your life? I have not a clue, but I like video games, you know, playing Pac-Man with my friends and such. So when the clipboard lady asked me if I enjoy computers, I say, yeah, the kind you can play. So she writes it down, computer science major. Well, you're going to need a rigorous mathematical background in order to get into the higher level courses. She prints out my course schedule. Analytic geometry 2, elementary probability, differential equations, and yes, I know that I have the math aptitude of a turnip. I'm that self-aware, but I think maybe just being in the classes with these people, maybe something will finally click into place. My first days are bewildering. Everyone speaks a language I do not understand, so I wait for the fog to clear. I go to class, I nod. Write things down in my little notebook. Go to class, I nod. Write things down in my little notebook. I power through, I listen, I open myself up to the instructions they are trying to impart. I'm optimistic. And I know it's just about to happen, just about to make sense. On my calendar, I can see it. Several exams, all scheduled for the same day. Whatever's gonna happen has to happen before that fateful hour. Something, a change, an aha moment, something, anything. And even on exam day, brushing my teeth, eating my cereal, walking toward my probability class, I expect this change to occur. And when the professor hands the exam to me, and I see that it's written in an alien language, for maybe the first time I understand that whatever the clipboard lady thinks, video games are not in my future. Today on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, we proudly present Caught Up. Amazing stories from real people trying to go with the flow. My name is Glenn Washington. Please remember not to paddle upstream, because you're listening. To Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Now, over here in Oakland, California, we have earthquakes. And you don't see them coming. The big ones, as they say, can hit any time. But out in the Midwest, they're big ones come in all shapes and sizes. And for our first story, we're going to take you right into the heart of the storm. And please be advised, when Snap Judgment goes into the heart of the storm, we go into the heart of the storm.
It started out like every other day. You wake up, you get ready, get clean, eat breakfast, go to work. I didn't have a car at the time, so I borrowed my parents' car and drove it up to the gas station, clocked in, and then just started helping people buy what they need. It was a really nice day, warm, sunny. My name is Reuben Carter. I was going to get my master's in psychology. I completed about half the master's program, and then I had to drop out and had to move back home with my family here in Missouri. And so I just took the first job I could find, and that was it. Now here I am working at a gas station, even though I have a bachelor's degree and half a master's. You know, I was like, you know, I really kind of want to be doing more than this.
That morning, we all got up and decided to go into town. It was a nice day, and we were just driving. I'm Isaac Duncan, I'm 27 years old. I had just got moved back from college. I liked moving home. That summer was kind of like in between school and job, so my two best friends were with me. We kind of grew up out in the country, so, you know, it was always fun just to drive around and listen to baseball.
I woke up pretty early in the morning. I'm from Kansas City, Missouri. My name is Stacy LaBarge. I stopped at the gas station to get a drink. My intentions was to just leave and get out of town. And then this old guy followed me out to my car and he said, you know, ma'am, you need to stay here. There's hail coming. And, you know, I'm pretty stubborn. So I thought, yeah, okay, I'm going. But he somehow I just believed him and I stayed.
The first thing that I remember is the emergency warning system on the radio. You know, there's a possibility of a tornado. Be careful. Pay attention. Be ready in case something happens.
I went up to pay, and I talked to Reuben at that time, and he's chattering about the weather, and he heard it on the radio. Oh, it's going to be a tornado. It's just going to be a bad storm.
It kind of changed really quick in there. Like, that's when the tornado sirens started going off. And they broke into the baseball game. There's always been sirens growing up, but I wasn't ever really that scared about it before.
When there's a potential of a pretty serious storm, I tend to take that relatively seriously. And so I was getting a little anxious.
Well, I was excited waiting for this tornado that I'm going to capture, you know, on my digital camera.
There were people buying beer, buying cigarettes, buying milk, snacks, drinks. At that point, I was like, you know, there are tornado sirens going off, people. Do you really want to die for a pack of cigarettes? And so everybody was just kind of like, oh, I can hear the tornado, or my friend's on the phone with me, and they're telling me that there's a tornado in this place in town, and it's coming this direction.
And we were like, maybe we should just pull in to the gas station. So we pulled in, and it's raining really hard. Run up to the door, and it's locked. And so we start banging on the door. Someone runs up and unlocks it. We get inside. There were 18 or 20 people. In the very back of the store, a mom kind of holding their kid, like her little kid was sitting on her lap. A young couple had a new puppy dog that they had just got, but I had my phone real close, you know, because I had been shooting video.
Where can we drive this direction?
I don't know.
Right before the tornado hit, there were three or four more people that I let in, because they had come up to the door and they were knocking on the door trying to get in.
At least probably 10 or 12.
9, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Hey, there's probably 18 or 19.
All total, there were 24.
We were all huddled on the back wall, and the wall started. It literally started breathing, so the walls were coming apart. And somebody said, hey, you know, what's in that room? And Reuben said, it's a beer cooler.
People were looking to me to find out what to do, just because I was the employee on duty at the time.
Hey, where do you want me to put everybody?
I had a hesitation as far as what to do.
On the inside hallway or towards the back by the beer cooler? You know?
My head was going crazy with 15,000 ideas. Do we stay here? Do we get up and run? Do we go inside somewhere? I'm petrified that I'm going to do the wrong thing. Several of my customers, one in particular, telling me that the beer cooler is not the place you want to go when you're in a tornado because they're not built for strength and resilience. And it was almost like the glass breaking was the idea crystallizing in my head that says, this is what you have to do. Everybody get in the cooler now.
We need it.
Where is that?
Some stuff breaking in the back.
Yeah, I know.
At that point, then everyone jumped up and ran in toward the cooler. People were tripping over each other and just kind of pushed the person in front of you.
So there was about a 2-foot space between the storage shelves, and it was about 20, 25 feet long. And I was the last person into the cooler, and as I reached out to grab the door, I saw the entire front of the store, windows and everything, just lift off the ground. My only thought in my head was, oh, I'm gonna die.
There was a girl behind me who, right when we got in there, she was just holding onto my shirt really hard, kind of like wadding up my shirt. Everyone was kind of like holding on to each other really close.
I noticed the little kids there screaming, crying, and I went over and, you know, talked to them a little bit. And, you know, I kind of stayed close to them because I was the only one there that had nobody else that I knew. I was just kind of talking to them calmly, and, you know, it's just like tornado drill in school. We're just going to kind of crouch down and put our hands over our head and everything's going to be okay. And, you know.
It was a really small space. The whole front wall of it was just stacked with metal shelves and Miller High Life and just a bunch of cheap cases of beer. I'm pretty claustrophobic, and my knee was underneath one of the metal shelves that had shifted. I hate being trapped like that. Like, that's one of my nightmares. I was definitely still recording at that point, but I wasn't thinking about it at that point. I was just holding it in my hand.
Everybody get down, low on the ground.
Come on. Sit right here.
It wasn't a feeling of wind. I didn't feel wind like I was, you know, going up in a twister.
Then everyone being just like a huge tangled mess, like everyone had fallen on top of each other. The whole cooler had shifted and like all the glass bottles had fallen off and shattered on the ground.
It was just a matter of holding on and trying to keep from getting sucked out into the tornado. And so I just grabbed on to the closest things that I had available to me, one of which was a support leg of some of the shelving that was there, and then the other was the person next to me. So I grabbed on with both hands and held on as hard as I could, holding on for life and trying not to get pulled out.
I remember thinking, I'm going to get hit in the head with, you know, a piece of wood or part of the building, and that's going to be the last feeling that I have.
Didn't know how I thought I was gonna die, but I just thought, you know, I was just waiting for it. Okay, when's this gonna happen? You know, let's do this now. Just, I felt scared. I didn't think about, you know, people say, oh, you relive your life and you see the white light, or, you know, a movie plays in your head. I didn't think once about anything like that. I was just waiting. It was a numbing feeling, I would say.
I was saying, I don't want to die, I don't want to die, I don't want to die.
There was one lady in the cooler that was like, Jesus!
Very panicked, very, like, I could tell in her voice she was scared to death.
Man, I never would have thought that I would be like a person that died in a tornado, but it's totally about to happen.
I don't want to die, but, you know, it
if I have to die, I have to die. And then, you know, this is it pretty much. I mean, at that point in time, there was no way that I could see that we were going to make it out of that alive.
Right when I realized that I kind of like came to terms with it, I'm probably going to die in a tornado. I looked over at Corey, who was my neighbor, you know, growing up, and he kind of like just looked over at me and was like, I love you, man. And I was like, love you too.
I love everyone. I love everyone, man.
Yeah, I love all you guys. We're gonna be okay.
I love you.
That just sort of started at one end of the cooler and went all the way down to the other end.
That just felt like, even though I didn't know anybody, it just felt like a connection.
I can honestly say I've felt a great deal of love for all of those people. Because you always think, oh, people are going to be out for themselves, especially if they're panicked or in danger or whatever. And that was one of those moments where you realize that it wasn't going to be like that. And so it was very peaceful.
Is everyone okay below me?
Right here, I'm okay.
All right, I'm trying not to lay on someone.
Somebody's on my back.
This is under me.
Immediately after the tornado had passed, we realized that, you know, at least we weren't in any more immediate danger. The only place we could see light was at the back of the cooler, where the roof had actually split open from the wall. And so we decided to climb out through the back, up the back wall and out through the hole in the roof. And so we built a makeshift ladder out of cases of beer.
When you first stuck your head out, it was just like really crazy because all the trees were gone. And when we turned around, like the building was pretty much completely gone. One of the only things that was had any form was kind of the cooler that we were in.
Yes.
We're not moving anywhere. The building and structure of the building may not be safe to move,
but I don't know. There really aren't any words for it other than just, oh my God, we lived through that. When I realized we had all survived, my first thought was, oh God, what if I miss somebody? What if somebody else was out there that I didn't see, didn't notice, couldn't get to? That was honestly one of the scariest things I ever thought in my life.
I climbed out of there and they helped me out. When I landed, it was crazy. Like it felt like I had jumped into another world. It was crazy. People running, cars going down the road with, you know, people with their heads out of their window, you know, just everybody. It was chaos. It was chaos. You know, it just looked like an atomic bomb went off.
I mean, there was smoke going up all over the place. There were cars and trees. We couldn't see anything that had not been destroyed. You're looking at the store afterward and the small space that we were in, it's pretty amazing to me that we were all hurt as little as we were. It did actually feel like a miracle. This is a storm that hit Joplin, Missouri on May 22nd, 2011. It was an EF5 tornado that was almost a mile wide, killed 158 people and injured 1,150 people.
I don't think I'm willing to chalk it up to like fate or anything like that, but I don't think that any force or God or anything like that chose for me to survive. I know for a fact that like other people around town got into coolers like that and it didn't always turn out as good as it did for us. So.
You know, everybody kind of worked together and kept us saying I love you afterwards, you know, it's kind of like a relief. And that's why, you know, probably the I love yous came about because we're like, wow, we made it, you know, Thank goodness we made it.
That story is produced as part of the Joplin Project, a collaboration between Snap Judgment and Esquire magazine. It was created by Snap's own Anna Sussman and Eliza Smith, along with Luke Dietrich, who first chronicled life inside the cooler for Esquire in 2011. Find a link to Luke's original Esquire article on classics.esquire.com. Leon Morimoto rocked that original score, and Isaac Duncan, well, Isaac recorded that entire adventure inside the beer cooler, inside the tornado. Thanks for that, Isaac. Thanks for the trip. And I'm happy to tell you that all of our survivors are thriving. And you remember our man, Reuben Carter, the hero of the day? Let's check in with him real quick. Hey, Reuben.
Hi, Glenn.
How you doing?
I am doing very well. How are you?
Fantastic. So, Reuben, tell us, how's the gas station going?
Gas station is going well. I'm hoping to get back into my school field line of work when I move to Texas in August. But for now, the gas station is going very well.
Well, gas station, new line of work, whatever, Reuben. We hear you've got something that you want to say to a special person in your life. Am I right?
Yes, sir.
Reuben, what do you want to say?
Every so often, somebody comes into your life that makes your life better just by being with them. And Kim is that person for me. And I want to make the rest of my life better by asking her to marry me.
Okay, Reuben. I hope, we all hope, it goes according to plan.
I hope so, too.
Right on. All right, Snappers. We're about to go now, live, to Reuben's living room, where he has a secret microphone set up. And he's about to pop the very big question.
I love you. You make me happier than anybody I've ever known in my life. You make my life better by being in it. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Will you marry me?
Yeah.
She said yes, Snappers. Congratulations, Reuben. Congratulations, Kim. We at Snap Judgment couldn't be happier for you guys. And we are so honored that we could be a part of your special moment. We wish you the very, very best and all happiness. Now, I don't want a bunch of marriage proposals, because even if you go through all hell in a tornado that rips and sanctifies your love, understand that you're second in line behind Reuben and Kim. Ha! Snap Judgment returns. We're going to show you how to make some easy money, baby. Don't worry. Everything's on the up and up. Snap Judgment, the Caught Up episode continues in just a moment.
Ask and you shall receive. Snap Judgment Live is going on tour. LA, Seattle, Portland, Mesa, Minneapolis, Detroit, Chicago, and more. Tour dates available at snapjudgment.org. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Caught Up episode. Today, we're exploring what happens when circumstances seem to run you over. Like, did you ever wonder how you ended up in your job? Or your city, your life? Have you ever looked around and thought, how did this happen? Well, you're going to want to listen to our next story. Mm-hmm.
Friday night, and Ephraim asked me if I wanted to go to a rabbi's house for dinner. We were just going, you know, for the free food and free drinks and to meet good-looking girls.
David Pakuz and Ephraim Divaroli were old friends from synagogue. They had actually left the Jewish faith, but free food was free food. So they got into Ephraim's old black Mercedes and drove through the streets of Miami Beach.
And while on the way, he was talking about his business. He said that he could introduce me to a business that would be much, much more lucrative than what I was doing now, and that he could prove that he was making a huge amount of money and he could teach me how to make it. And so I asked him, well, how much money are you making? And he said, well, this is top secret information. And I said, well, you'd expect me to join you in business and you won't even tell me how much money you're making. I need to know what the potential is. And right then we had arrived at the rabbi's house and he turned off the car and he looked at me and he's like, I'm only telling you this to inspire you, not because I'm bragging. I have $1.8 million in the bank. And he was 18 years old.
David was a part-time massage therapist, putting himself through college. So almost $2 million in the bank was both totally alien and completely captivating. Their group of friends passed their time sneaking into hotel pools. To David, Ephraim was an unlikely owner of a multi-million dollar business.
He just seemed like a total clown and, you know, just like another stoner. He was constantly scheming about different ways of making money. So I knew he was making money. I mean, he was said he was making money, but I had no idea how much. Well, when he told me he had $1.8 million in the bank, I said, holy I couldn't believe it.
When Ephraim told David about how much money he made, David had only one question.
So what is it exactly, what is it that you do? And he said, well, the government is always looking to buy things. For example, handguns or various common ammunition. They don't really care who they get it from as long as they get the best price and from someone who's reliable who will actually deliver it. So they put it out for open bid.
Most of the contracts Ephraim won were military contracts. Basically, he was an arms dealer.
You know, my mind was swimming. I couldn't believe that he actually had made that much money. He definitely didn't live like a millionaire. And we had some drinks, and pretty much I was quiet the whole time, just thinking about it. And by the end, I told him, you know, I'll give it a shot. My plan was to make a few million dollars and then get out and do what I like doing in order to live the life I always wanted.
Ephraim took David to his office, which was actually just his apartment, opened up his laptop, and said,
let me show you how it works.
Ephraim was getting contracts to sell arms and ammo from a website, fedbizops.gov. On FedBizOps, he would scan the listings for contracts he thought he could win. The listings read almost like a Craigslist ad, except instead of asking for help mowing the lawn, these ads ask for large quantities of military supplies. You can find ads for everything from guided missiles to Black Hawk helicopter landing gear to, strangely, corncob grounds.
My first contract that I actually won was for 50,000 gallons of propane.
Well, I would have no idea where to find that much propane. How did you know where to go?
Google. That's it. Really?
Oh, okay, but can I Google where to find, like, 50,000 grenades or AK-47s?
Absolutely. Of course you can. Who makes grenades? Who makes AK-47s? A range of companies do it, and those companies are looking to sell as long as they think you will buy and that you're legally allowed to do so. Most companies dealing with government contracts are large companies. You have your Lockheed Martins, your Boeings, General Dynamics. These are Fortune 500 companies with tens of thousands of employees. And we were just two guys in a living room smoking weed and bidding on contracts. It's kind of like the local lemonade stand going against Tropicana. We actually won a fair amount, and we started winning more and more as we kind of learned how to work the system. We were working at his desk. He had a big desk in his living room that we had two laptops on, old laptops, and piles of paper everywhere. This was 2005, 2006. There's these two huge wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, raging, and the government was looking to buy massive quantities of things. They were looking to buy huge amounts of bed sheets and body armor and bullets and air conditioners and trucks and pretty much anything you could think of they were looking to buy. But because he had a lot of experience in military equipment, he focused on that. 80 to 90% of the business was weapons and ammunition. On a typical day, we would work around 18 hours. And that's pretty much from when we would wake up until when we would fall asleep. And we would order delivery so we wouldn't have to leave to get food so we could eat while we worked. I'd never worked so hard in my life.
So they'd be eating Chinese noodles from a carton and sleeping on the floor and delivering weapons to Colombia and Germany. They'd been on contracts for Nepal, Niger, and Chad.
But most of the business was in Iraq and later in Afghanistan.
As they bid on these contracts, David saw the promise of really big money flash on the screen before him. If everything went well, he could be making millions.
There were many moments I considered backing out, but then I would see the money, you know, coming in. I just told myself I could put up with it for a little bit longer. I just need to make some money and then I'll quit. So I was planning on retiring after that and traveling the world and buying a yacht and living the good life. That was the plan. Who is it? I forgot who it was. It was some one of the robber barons, the guy who cornered the silver market in the 1800s. A reporter asked him, how much money would it be enough? And he said, more.
Then David got a call that promised all the money he wanted and then some. It was the call to step up into the high-stakes arena of the big-time arms dealers.
I was driving to see my girlfriend and have dinner with her. And Ephraim called me and he said, I just saw one of the biggest solicitations, request for quotation, I've ever seen on FedBizOps, which is bigger than anything I've ever seen. And you have to come to the office right now. We got to discuss it. And I told him, I'm on the way to dinner with my girlfriend. And he said, he's like, well, bleep that. You want to like hang out with your girl? You want to get rich?
David and Ephraim pored over the contract. It was a deal to supply all the munitions for the new Afghan army and police force. So they got to work.
We looked at the request for a quote, and it was huge. I mean, it was like 100 million rounds of AK-47 ammo, 100,000 grenades, anti-aircraft rockets. It was enormous.
David spent 2 months working around the clock. He called every contact in the world he thought might be able to supply the stuff for the contract, scouring the planet for lots and lots of bullets.
I was calling Russia, I was calling Ukraine, I was calling Bulgaria, I was calling Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, Korea. Calling most of these countries, they usually don't speak English very well, so I would just say, English, 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 I want to buy, I want to buy. We would say, oh yeah, I'll get my my sales team working on that, or I'll have my my accountant contact you, or
we'll get our procurement division on that right away, sir.
We would act like we had like a whole staff, but of course it was just us two. We lied all the time.
David and Ephraim put in a bid for the Afghan ammo at $300 million, and they won. They were the lowest bidder by far, partly because two guys in an apartment have a lot less overhead than a company with tens of thousands of employees.
It was It was, how do I put it? It was surreal. It was very odd. I was myself on a constant basis. It was a constant state of panic. Without us, the Afghan army had no ammunition, and they wouldn't be able to fight the Taliban.
It doesn't stop there. Don't go anywhere. The stunning conclusion of Accidental Arms Dealer in just a moment on Snap Judgment. The Caught Up episode continues. Stay tuned. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Caught Up episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and when last we left, Davis Pakus and his partner Ephraim were in quite a fix. And David, he's got a habit of going from the frying pan into the fire.
Without us, the Afghan army had no ammunition, and they wouldn't be able to fight the Taliban.
The hard part now was that David and Ephraim actually had to find the ammo and the weapons to fulfill the contract.
In Abu Dhabi, every year there is one of the biggest arms exhibitions in the world. I went there by myself to try to source ammunition for the Afghan contract. It was like the cantina scene in Star Wars. Pretty much every degenerate in the world was there, or at least in my mind. You'd see generals in full military gear, you know, sleazy-looking businessmen, government officials. Pretty much every single country was represented. Chinese generals, Africans, Europeans, everyone was just having cocktails together. And it was just incredible to me because I knew some of these people are mortal enemies and they're fighting each other. And here they are and they're just, you know, schmoozing over cocktails. Rumors were flying around of you know, who was going to go to war next, where the best countries were to get the best prostitutes. During the day, you're in the exhibition halls. They had very expensive bottles of wine and champagne and, you know, caviar and hors d'oeuvres and, you know, really good-looking women to serve it all. They spared no expense. Outside, they had live fire weapons drills where they would have, like, tanks jumping sand dunes and, like, blowing things up and helicopter gunships. And it was, like, live military drills that you could watch. There were bleachers where everyone would stand and, you know, drinks and hors d'oeuvres being passed around. And it was like being at a big football game where, you know, the sport was military maneuvers. I was by far the youngest person there, of course, because everyone in this business is military or ex-military. So they're all like men in their middle ages. And they just looked at me as if I was, you know, some kid and they were wondering what I was doing there, which is why I always had copies of our contract in my briefcase to prove that, you know, I was the real deal and actually had real business deals to do.
Was the arms business, in your experience, kind of more morally dubious than other industries? Was it shadier?
The arms business, by its nature, is definitely shadier and more dubious because arms could be used for great evil. And the people that you're dealing with sometimes sell to people who use them for great evil. But at the time, did it stop me? No, it didn't.
David kept working to get the guns and the bullets, but as they worked, these wayward kids from Miami Beach that snuck into the halls of power started to get some unwanted attention.
Because we were winning so many contracts, we were upsetting a lot of our competitors. You know, they worked real hard on these contracts and they kept on losing them to us. They started slandering us to various people in Iraq. They started telling people that we were coke dealers, and that's how we got the money to fund the contract.
David was sending plane loads of ammo all over the globe for the Afghan arms contract. At one point, he had over 5,000 tons of bullets waiting to be loaded into cargo planes in Albania. And it was there that the two-man operation began to crumble against the powerful tectonic plates of the international arms trade.
Albania is famous for, how do you put it? Let's put it this way. The State Department guy told us, you know, most third world countries are third world, but Albania is kind of like the fifth world. They need to be supervised.
He sent a friend over to Albania to check on the deal, make sure the ammo wasn't faulty, and to repackage it so it would cost less in air freight. But when their friend walked into the underground Albanian bunker and saw the piles of bullets, he immediately called David.
When he went over there, he told us, hey, you know, this there's Chinese letters all over the boxes. And we had no idea. We were like, oh, well, uh-oh, this could be a problem.
Here's the thing about Chinese ammo. It was illegal. Their contract said it explicitly. And while technically this ammo hadn't been bought directly from the Chinese, they knew this mountain of Chinese ammo was a really big problem.
We discovered that it was Chinese ammunition, and then we figured, well, it's better not to tell the army about this. What they don't know won't hurt them. The ammunition is excellent quality, and that's all that really matters. It's not enriching the Chinese government in any way, and that's all that the anti-Chinese ban was meant to be about. It'll be fine. So we took the ammunition out of the wooden crates that they were packed in and out of the metal sardine cans, and we packaged it in plastic bags and in cardboard boxes. We were very careful not to include any papers that had Chinese letters in the boxes, so there was no more Chinese words on the packaging once we had repackaged it. And so we started delivering, and we delivered, I think, by the end, close to 70 aircraft loads of ammunition, each holding around 45 tons.
He says anybody would have done that. He says shenanigans like this happen every day in the arms trade. The big boys don't get caught. But David and Ephraim were not the big boys. A rival competitor, an Albanian businessman who had been cut out of a deal, started this whisper campaign against David and Ephraim. He told a Pentagon official to check him out. And soon, David and Ephraim's office was raided by the feds.
And the government eventually decided that that constituted fraud. As they say, it was a conspiracy to defraud the United States of America. Well, I felt like my life was over. Because they said, okay, you have 71 aircraft loads that you delivered to Afghanistan, each one with a certificate saying that the point of origin is Albania, and you signed off on that, and really the origin was China, and therefore each aircraft load delivery, each document you signed, is one count of fraud. And each count of fraud has a maximum of 5 years in prison. So 71 counts of fraud for 71 aircraft loads is around 350 years in prison.
And did you ever, I don't know, I mean, I feel like all of us in our dark moments of shame feel like, I don't know, there's some kind of like celestial checks and balances. Like, did you ever feel like you were caught because of greed? Because you had been being greedy?
I did think that. When I got caught and I realized that I was facing possibly a lifetime in prison, a lot of things go through your head. And you evaluate your entire life and how you got up to this point and how you could be so stupid and all the mistakes that you've made. And one of the big ones I was constantly thinking about was getting involved in the business in the first place. And I wondered why I did it. Of course, I knew. But I thought that it was almost like a punishment for kind of turning a blind eye towards certain things. And I wish I had never gotten involved in it in the first place, that's for sure.
In fact, David never saw any of the money he dreamed of. So now he was broke and a federal criminal.
Like any sane person caught up in the system, I pled guilty, and they reduced my charges down to, you know, from 71 counts of fraud to one count of fraud. Eventually, the judge had mercy on me and gave me just 7 months of house arrest and 7 months probation.
He had to reset. There would be no more drinking cocktails and watching rocket launches with African warlords. Instead, after serving his house arrest, David walked out of his apartment, armed, with a backpack full of scented candles and soothing music.
Well, I went back to doing massage, you know, to make ends meet. Would have my massage table on a cart and, you know, a little bag with all my equipment, such as essential oils and massage oil and, you know, music. But it was strange. It was definitely strange. After I went back into massage, I, you know, informed all of my former clients that I was doing massage again, and the vast majority of them were very thrilled to hear that. And they asked me, so, what have you been doing the last year or two? And I would say, yeah, it's a long story. It's been interesting.
Big thanks to David Pacuz for sharing your story. If you want to find out the dirty, dirty, gritty, gritty behind this piece, check out the book written by Guy Lawson. Out in stores right now, it's called Arms and the Dudes. Find the link on our website, snapjudgment.org. The piece was produced by Anna Sussman and Julia DeWitt in collaboration with Guy Lawson. The original score and sound design by our own Renzo Gorio. All right, it's about that time. But Glenn, I missed some of the episode. Glenn, I need more stories. Give me some more stories, man. Hey, player, it's going to be all right. I've got exactly what you need. Subscribe to the Snap Judgment Storytelling Podcast and get your fix today. SnapJudgment.org. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. We deliver your way. And don't miss out on the Snap Nation conversation. Twitter, Facebook. Tell the world what you think. Today's Snap Judgment episode was brought to you by myself, the letter R, and the finest group of audio magicians the world has ever known. Please, let them take a bow. The Uber producer, Mark Ristich. The beat of the beat, Pat Massini-Miller. Anna Sussman blows off jury duty. Julia DeWitt carries a lighter. Davey, too fast, too furious. Kim can't take the bus. Joe Rosenberg found a rack of suits just laying in the street. He can give you a good deal. Nancy Lopez uses her knife for purposes other than cooking. Eliza Smith bites the bullet. Anna Adlerstein bites. Leon Morimoto wears his sunglasses at night. Matthew Enforcer Ducat and Jasmine Aguilera is here to see you now. Did you ever push things off the side of a tall building just to see what would happen? Well, next time I promise not to push things belonging to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I honestly didn't know computers could just splinter like that. Much love, though, to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, is now exchanging things other than public radios. Stop by their offices with some of your old junk. They'll take it. Tell them Glenn sent you. PRX. .org. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could hear the tornado sirens blowing ask your girlfriend to marry you right then and there, only to realize that you don't have a girlfriend. And your mother's friends are all looking at you funny. And you will still, even then, not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.